I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Michael Kwan joins me again, the freelance writer, author, and blogger, has a new book out, Beyond the Baby Babble, Surviving Life as a Work-at-Home Dad. It's a look at his experiences as a father working from home, raising a daughter, and from the anecdotes he provides, he offers the reader or would-be parent some useful advice. I've always thought the best advice is to take everybody's advice and see what works from experience. Mike examines the role of fatherhood and how that's changed in his personal experience from being a son and to now being a father. He battles the stereotypes and misconceptions that society has about gender roles, especially since he's a work-at-home dad raising a daughter. I've known Michael for 22 years. We didn't grow up together, but because we met in high school in grade 8. So really, we've grown older together. I've seen my friend grow into a husband and a dad, and if you read this book, you get a good sense of who this guy is and just what kind of father he is. MichaelKwan.com is the website for more. The Twitter handle is at Michael Kwan. His previous books are Beyond the Margins and Make Money Online. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Michael Kwan. Mr. Kwan, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Adeline is how old now?
She just turned 3.
And so it's amazing because I had lunch with you and Suzanne, a year or so ago?
About a year ago.
It's probably more than a year ago.
Now.
And she was like, what, a year and a half, I guess?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, like I was, like I said, I don't know if I said it in the book or in a blog post or something, but like the original plan for this book was to cover the first year of her life.
Yeah.
So like she was born in 2014. So I was originally planning on having this out by like holiday season 2015.
Yeah.
And then life gets in the way and I blink my eye and she's 3. Right?
You make plans and then it doesn't all work out. But it has worked out because she's 3. Is she in school now or like preschool?
She just started preschool. So it's only twice a week. We actually just dropped her off and picked her up this morning. Yeah.
So you have a little bit more time to yourself, I guess, at home now working, right?
Yes and no, I guess. Yeah. Like, the preschool that she's going to, they have a program that's called Gradual Entry. So when we first started out, it was only an hour class, and the first class, we were actually there with her. So the idea is that, you know, they know that the kids are young, and, like, being away from mommy and daddy is difficult and confusing and whatever. So, like, the full class is 2 hours, and she just had her first 2-hour class on Monday. So it's been, like, a month, right? So I haven't had the experience of what her normal preschool schedule would be like yet.
And is this something that as a parent, as a work-at-home dad, you're looking forward to, say?
It's bittersweet.
Yeah, I'll bet, yeah.
Like, it's bittersweet because then it's like, you know, she's, in my eyes, she will always be like my little baby girl. Like, I remember when she fit between my hand and the crook of my elbow kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So it's like seeing her grow up and like when, one thing that's been really, again, kind of good and bad is that when we drop her off at preschool now, we give her the hug and the kiss, okay, we'll see you in a couple hours. We were anticipating the possibility of like separation anxiety and all that, but she's like, okay, bye, mommy, daddy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh,
because most
you don't need me anymore.
Yeah,
you know?
Because most kids do that, I think, or feel that way.
To an extent. Like they said like the first couple classes, like none of the kids cried, but like you could see that they were kind of sad that their mom or dad wasn't there. And like especially for Adeline, because she hasn't been in daycare or any kind of group environment or anything like that.
Yeah.
Being away from family for any period of time is strange, right?
And parenting has changed, hasn't it, from say when you were 3 and now your kid's 3, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And do you think technology has played a part in that?
Yes. Because Adeline, she already understands how touch screens work.
Mm.
Like, to an extent. She obviously can't, like, navigate the web or anything like that.
Yeah.
But if she sees that there is a picture on the screen, she understands, like, pinch to zoom. She knows to swipe to go to the next picture.
I don't know that yet.
See, like, things like that. And, like, but because she grew up around technology and around touch screens and around the internet and all that, like, we have Netflix on our TV, like most people do. And, you know, at the end of episode, it says, like, playing next episode in 19 seconds or whatever, and has a little thumbnail in the corner. The bottom right corner of our TV is filled with little baby fingerprints. Because she's like, I want to watch this one. And she starts slamming on the TV. It's like, no, the TV is not a touchscreen.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That she hasn't really wrapped her head around that because her expectation is everything is a touchscreen.
Yeah. We didn't grow up with, we didn't even grow up with keyboards, really, did we?
Not really. Well, that's actually something that I brought up in my vlog, what, last week or the week before, is that, like, me and you, we're kind of that last, like, straddling generation where we had, like, an analog childhood but, like, a digital adulthood. Because, mm-hmm. like, the internet kind of became... It became a thing when we were in high school, mostly. And, like, at the time, it was, like, dial-up and, like, websites loaded terribly and had all these ugly, flashy graphics. And obviously, the internet's very different today. But, like, when we were kids, it was, you know, you go play outside, you go kick a ball or read a book or whatever. It wasn't about staring at a tablet. And I see this more and more that, and I'm guilty of this too, that parents have come to rely on these screens as digital babysitters because, like, we just need a break.
Yeah.
So, like, especially if you're sitting at a busy restaurant and you know the kid's going to be fussy, it's like, okay, just
use this.
Watch some YouTube and leave me alone.
Yeah. You talk in the book about how things have changed for parenting, and this goes into the online technology part of it. There are a lot of resources for parents online. Groups, and then you talk about the groups that you belong to and, mm-hmm. and the forums that you're able to say, learn about. If you've got questions, you can pose it to a group of parents or a group of dads.
Right.
And that's obviously helped. How are you able to navigate between, say, what's real and what's useful and what's not?
I think that's a big difference between our generation and our parents' generation, too. Because, like, for my parents, if there was anything that happened to me and my brother that they're concerned about or whatever, the resource that they would have is they would either go to the doctors and make an appointment and chat it up. But more likely than not, they would just ask relatives, and it would all be like these long pieces of advice that they would have traditionally learned from their parents and so on.
Yeah.
But now we have so many more resources online, WebMD and Baby Center and all the forums and stuff. It's almost the opposite problem. That we have too much information. And what I found overwhelmingly is that no matter what your question is or no matter what your issue is, you will inevitably find at least a half dozen people that are telling you exactly the opposite thing. So I think there's something that we discussed, I think, just before the interview, where it's like you take in all the information that you can and you just kind of pick and choose the pieces that work best for you.
Yeah.
As long as the child is reasonably happy and healthy, yeah. All the more power to you. Like, I remember, like, when Adeline was, like, a baby, like when she was still in her crib.
Yeah.
Some people will say that, oh, the crib should be completely devoid of any blankets and stuffed animals and stuff because there's suffocation hazards. Fair enough.
Yeah.
That's a reasonable risk to consider. Other people will be like, no, you want to have the plushies in them because it creates, like, a comfortable, warm, inviting environment that they want to go to. Like, well, that's a valid argument, too. So, like, there is no real right or wrong answer there. You just kind of pick what you think works best for you and your family.
You mentioned in the book, your wife, Suzanne, the sort of advice that you would get from family, and a lot of it would be superstition even.
Yeah.
And so growing up as you have here in Canada with, say, sort of the traditional stuff that your parents' generation had, there was a lot to wade through that even, right?
Yeah, and for the most part, we ignored most of that. Like, all the respect to my parents, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, I know they all mean well, but for people like us that grew up in Canada that, you know, are reasonably well-educated, we prefer things that have been scientifically proven or, you know, like Western medicine that has its rigorous testing as opposed to superstition, really. And, like, this isn't to discount people that find value in traditional Chinese medicine or acupuncture or mm-hmm. anything like that. It's just, again, it's not for us.
Or practical or it didn't particularly work in your case or for your child, right?
Well, like, we didn't believe in it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, there are, like, superstitions where it's like, oh, the expectant mother shouldn't eat watermelon because then the baby's head's going to be too big. And I'm like, that doesn't sound reasonable.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, some of the other traditional Chinese things, like, okay, we can see how, oh, she should be eating more of this or drinking more of that because it's nutrient-rich and it'll help the fetus grow, da-da-da. That I'll buy into, but, like, the things that I don't see how that would make logical sense, we don't follow.
You write in the book as well about the arrangement at your house, because you work at home, you're a work at home dad. It worked out for you in your family because the child was with you. You didn't have to have a babysitter,
right.
or you didn't have to send your child away to
daycare.
Yeah. What does that do for your productivity?
It was difficult, and it still is very difficult. A big part of the reason why I got into freelancing in the first place is that I wanted to have that sense of flexibility as well as a sense of like control over my schedule. I work when I want to, quote unquote, which isn't completely true because it's obviously there's
obligations. Yeah.
Yeah, there's obligations, and you know, there's some clients that I need to work with daily, and I should be online each morning or whatever. But for the most part, I have some flexibility in my schedule. And what I found is the average typical worker, you typically have to accommodate your life responsibilities around your work schedule. If you work on Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and you need to go see the dentist, you either have to try to book a day off, or you go see them on the weekend, or you run your errands on the weekend.
Yeah.
For me, what I'm finding more and more is I'm doing exactly the reverse, that I'm allowing like life responsibilities to dictate my schedule, and then I find pockets where I can work.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is necessarily the best approach. I've had a lot of people tell me, it's like, oh, you should have more of a strict schedule, so you have more structure. Because what I find is, you know, a lot of times I'll set up a to-do list at the beginning of the day, and I'm like, I want to get through X, Y, and Z tasks, but I may not necessarily find the time to do all of it during the day, and more often than not I'd end up working after I've already put Adeline down to sleep. So I was a night owl before, but when I know that she's gonna be awake at 7, it's like I kind of need to I need to be awake
yeah.
at 7, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to before, if I was a night owl and then I woke up at like 10 or 11, it made no real difference.
Yeah.
So,
and you wouldn't trade that time that you've had these last 3 years with, you know, with her.
No, absolutely not. So then like, and the other thing is that the sense of timing and productivity in my schedule has continued to change as she's continued to change.
Mm.
So when she was an infant for the first 5 or 6 months, she needed to be fed every 2 or 3 hours or so. And she would only sleep for like an hour or two at a time. And it's just like this endless cycle for 24 hours. So I actually found that in the first little while, as tired as we were because we didn't get a real night's sleep or anything, I found that my work sessions were much more focused. And I was able to get a lot more done in less time because I'm like, if she's falling asleep now, I know I have about a couple hours to get something done. Mm-hmm. What can I accomplish in those couple hours? And I just like, I burn through it.
Yeah.
But like, as she was able to stay awake longer, as her feeding schedule changed, then the more that she was awake, the less that I was able to focus on work as opposed to taking care of her. And I don't want to give off the inaccurate perception that I'm like 100% I am the only parent who is taking care of my daughter. Obviously, obviously Sudan is there. My mom helps out a lot.
Yeah.
So I don't want to give the impression that I'm doing everything.
You're super dad.
Yeah, like clearly not. I'm clearly not super dad. But that said, yeah, like finding the time to be able to get work done in between, you know, being a dad is difficult. And like, especially now that she's a lot older now and she's able to vocalize her wants and needs. She's much more aware of what's going on, even if she doesn't actually see it.
Mm-hmm.
So before, if I disappear into my home office and close the door, Daddy was gone. Mm. I did not exist in the house. Wherever I was, she didn't know that I was there. But now, I've moved my office to another floor in hopes that I would be able to separate myself from that so then Addie can be playing with Grandma or with Suzanne or whatever. But inevitably, at some point, she'll scream down the stairs, like, Daddy, come play with me. And it's like, I want to work.
Yeah.
I feel like I should be working. But like, how do you say no to that?
Yeah,
and that's a big challenge.
And because it'll be so fast.
And all of a sudden...
You know, she won't want to talk.
Yeah, exactly.
Anymore, right?
Like,
yeah.
It won't be long before she's a teenager and she hates me forever, right?
Yeah. So are you able, in not just raising a child, but working from home and having a work-life balance, are you able to have that, working from home and...
It's an integration.
Because a lot of people would say that working from home would be great because you don't have to get dressed up, you don't have to take a commute or whatever.
Right.
But I guess at the same time, some people think that it's just leisure.
Oh, it's definitely not leisure.
Yeah, yeah.
It's definitely not leisure. And working from home definitely isn't for everyone. It really depends on, like, your work preferences and your personality. Because, like, I've had friends that have tried doing the work-at-home thing, and it didn't work out for them for whatever reason. Because part of it is... If you don't have a supervisor or a manager or even other coworkers looking over your shoulder, the only person that's motivating you or encouraging you to keep working is yourself. And especially now with boundless opportunities for procrastination, it's like, oh, I'll just watch another YouTube video. I'll disappear on Facebook. Mm-hmm. It's hard to maintain that kind of focus. And the other half of it, and I've talked about this at length on the blog, is... Because I can work at any time, I feel like I should be working all the time.
Mm.
So it's very difficult on the opposite end of that spectrum to say, like, okay, after dinner, I'm done with the day. I'm not going to do any more work. I'm going to go watch a movie or play with my kid or whatever. And then my phone buzzes and I get an email from a client. It's like, oh, it's only going to take me 30 seconds to reply to this email.
Yeah.
And then they send something back. I'm like, oh, I guess I'll just turn on the computer quickly. I'll just quickly edit this thing. Well, while I'm editing this thing, I might as well find an appropriate image to go with it. Well, since I'm finding the image, I might as well upload it to WordPress. Like, it snowballs,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You write in the book about what it's like not only to raise a daughter, you being a dad, but taking the active role in raising your child, as you have.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we're of a generation where that's not only acceptable, but expected. Previous generations, it was not.
Not at all. Like,
yeah.
And something that I talked about in the book is when Suzanne's maternity leave was coming to an end, because we're fortunate enough that she was able to take a full year.
Yeah.
We went out to dinner with my in-laws, like the extended family, and one of the questions that several of the elders asked is like, oh, if Suzanne's going back to work, who's going to take care of the kid?
Mm.
And I'm like, me?
Yeah.
I'm already at home. Their assumption was that a man is not capable of childcare, not capable of changing diapers and feeding and all that. Because it's like, one is that he's not capable of that, and two, that's not a man's place. And attitudes have definitely shifted a lot among our generation, and there is an expectation that husbands should be contributing just as much as their wives, but I think we're not there yet.
It has been slow socially and culturally. I mean,
yes, there's still kind of this stigma, right? So, like, when for example, when we took her to story time at the library, there were instances where I was literally the only dad there, surrounded by moms. And even like this morning, when I went to pick up Addie from preschool, I was the only dad there, surrounded by all the other moms. And I understand that, you know, most people work a 9-to-5 and whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, it's still the expectation that it's the man that will be going back to work and he'll be doing the 9-to-5, and it's the woman who will have to transition to being a stay-at-home mom or take on more of those kind of responsibilities. And we also see that still a lot in kind of popular culture. This kind of subtext through advertising and movies and TV shows, where you're more likely to see the mom as the martyr, the super mom doing all these things, and then there's this bumbling husband that doesn't seem to know what he's doing. And I'm sure there are husbands that are terrible, and I'm sure there are moms that are great.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't be perpetuating that narrative, because all it does is it perpetuates that myth that there should be a supermom.
Saying that moms can only do this and dads can only do this.
Right.
Part. When you think of sort of what kind of parent your daughter will be. Hopefully by then it'll change, right?
We hope so.
Yeah.
But there's no way for us to
really know. Yeah. And I've seen this online. People say that you're a good dad. And then I'm thinking to myself, well, I mean, I guess we take for granted that women or mothers do that already. That
yeah. And this
you would never hear someone say you're a good mom.
Exactly. Like, well, this is exactly the same thing that I was going back to about before, like the super mom and the bubbly husband. If those compliments, they feel like they're a positive step, but again, all they're doing is perpetuating this narrative that they're if a father is able to fulfill the bare expectations of parenting, he's a good dad.
Yeah.
And if a mother is anything less than that, then she's terrible, and that's unfair to both sexes.
Yeah. I see that with dads all the time online.
Yeah.
That oh, this is a surprise that this is what, you know, that they actually cared about their child.
Yeah, it's like, know? That shouldn't be a surprise. Yeah. It should be that's the minimum expectation.
Yeah. What was the feeling like when you first saw Adeline for the first time?
It's like you kind of know right away that your life will never be the same. And it's cliche to say that, oh, I fell in love with her in the first sight, because that's not really what it is, because obviously you don't know this person or anything yet. But it's more this understanding that nothing will ever be the same again. Like, it's by far the most life-changing event for me, more than, you know, moving out or going to school or getting a job, getting married, anything like that. All these, like, life milestones that people go through. Because it's that realization that it's not about you. Mm-hmm. It's not about you anymore, right? Yeah. It's all about her. So, like, everything that we do is for the purpose of hopefully that she has a happier, brighter life, brighter future.
And you write in the book right away, I guess even before she was born, I guess, did you decide on the name already?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you were online looking for websites and Twitter handles.
Yeah.
What concerns did you have then or have now about what's shared online? Because you get warned by people about what to put online that's of your child.
Yeah, and like we were saying before, our generation is very different than our parents' generation heavily because of technology. And that's an issue that I've struggled with before she was born, clear through to now. And I imagine it's only going to become more difficult as she gets older
and technology becomes what it becomes, right?
Yeah, because, you know, a teenage girl on social media it's a risk for her. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't know how to navigate that, and it's been one of those things that I've kind of decided on a case by case basis. And I think another part of it has to do with the parents' comfort level for how much they share of their own lives to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the social butterfly that's sharing all the stuff on Instagram, YouTube, and whatever, Snapchat, if you're already that kind of person, it wouldn't surprise me if when you become a parent that you kind of do the same, like, oh, look at my cute baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely understand that for a lot of people, it's like, okay, we're tired of looking at your baby. Because as soon as you become a parent, that's all you post about. But I also have friends that they're on social media, but they're not especially active.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that they'd be more inclined to not share, because that's already their mindset, that they don't want to share much of their private lives to begin with. So it's not easy.
Yeah, I guess being online is not easy,
and like
for any of us, right?
No, I mean, and especially in the case of children who can't choose or speak for themselves, you're making the decision on their behalf, as opposed to when you decide to share something from your own life, that's only on you. A few months ago, I came across an article of a young girl whose father and mother shared her childhood extensively, a bunch of embarrassing stories, mm-hmm. and on their Tumblr and all that. She's since, I guess, like a tween now, maybe like 12 years old, mm-hmm. or something like that. And then she wrote like an article about how that's impacted her, because anything that's on the internet is forever. you might delete the Facebook post, you might delete the Medium post or whatever that you've written. It's archived somewhere. If someone wants to find it, it is archived somewhere. So it's that hard decision of understanding that, like, anything you put out there is not for those that fleeting moment of likes and comments. It's something that can be dug up 10, 20, 30 years from now. And that might come back to bite them when, for their job prospects or applying to college or if they get into politics or whatever, now here's a picture of her having an accident on the potty or whatever. It's like, it's embarrassing.
You write in the book very sensibly about how much it costs to have a kid, and they won't ask you for a figure, but it does cost a lot, doesn't it?
It was surprising in that there are a lot of costs involved, but partly due to sort of lifestyle changes and shifting priorities.
Yeah.
Our monthly expenses end up being not that different.
Yeah, you write in the book about how you guys made it work.
Yeah.
Well, with clothing and the sort of food that you would eat and that the right. child would eat.
Right, because then, like, you know, prior to having Adeline, it's not out of the ordinary for us to go to concerts and watch movies and go out to eat, and we'd have more of, like, this outside of the home, leisure life, hobbies, whatever. But those funds just end up getting diverted into things for the kid instead. We're spending them on diapers and clothes and yeah. whatever. So kids are expensive in that there's a lot of, like, stuff. But most parents will find that other areas of your life will automatically kind of compensate for it. At yeah. least that's what's happened in our life, and I'm sure everyone's situation is different, but that's kind of what happened with us.
And being online, as I said, it, you know, it's a difficult for everybody, but in terms of raising a child, did you succumb to any of those things, you know, the keeping up with the Joneses and getting certain things for the child that say, other people had for their children?
Not yet. Not so much in terms of things, but in terms of expected milestones for the child. So, like, oh, your kid's 6 months now. Why aren't you feeding her solid food yet? Oh, your kid's a year now. She really should be walking by now. And especially because, like, I have friends who are parents, and I even have several friends whose children are, like, within a year of Adeline. So when they share things on Facebook, it's like, oh, so-and-so is walking now, or so-and-so is eating solids now. Oh, look how proud I am that he's able to do whatever. And then I see Adeline isn't, or vice versa. It's more that than, like, physical things or going out to do certain activities.
Certain strollers or certain cribs.
Yeah, like, that's never been an issue for me.
Yeah.
I know that it can be an issue for a lot of parents, because you'll see people, like, now that I'm a parent, I'm much more cognizant of different baby products and brands and things like that I'm sure I've encountered a million times before, but I don't even think about.
Yeah.
So like you were saying, it's like, oh, name brand strollers and whatever. Like, we have one that's functional and it works fine for us.
Yeah.
But we realize that having the name brand high-end stroller is no different than you having the nice car or the nice coat or you got the fancy new Fendi shoes or whatever. It's a fashion statement like anything else. Is the more expensive stroller better? Maybe, maybe not. But it is, it's a status thing, right?
Are you, after the experience, better at giving advice to people? Are you good at giving advice to people?
Am I good at giving advice to people? You'd have to ask them and not me.
like when you encounter parents, for example, do you tell them, oh yeah, this is what we did and this is what you should do? But because from what I read in the book, probably you're cautious about it because you know the sort of advice that you got, and you sort of
accepted
a lot of it, but whether you used it or not was not right.
What I usually, if I'm asked for advice for any area of childcare, infant care, or whatever, I'll usually frame it in that this is what we did, and this is why we think it worked for us, and this is what we did, and this is, we wished we had done it this way instead.
Mm.
So I'm hesitant to tell people, it's like, oh, you should definitely do it this way, because I'm very aware of the fact that every parent is different, every child is different, and there are no real blanket statements that can necessarily apply to everyone. So I can only speak from my own experience. I'm like, this is what we did, and it worked.
Are you still finding people judgy about parenting?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so even if you're dropping the child off at daycare or at the library, or you're participating in some activity at the community center, you still get looks from people and things like that?
Me personally? Or?
Yeah, because, I mean, you are a dad with a daughter. Because that was something that you had to overcome as well, right?
Yeah, like, it's harder for me to make those kind of inroads with the moms if I'm the only if I'm the only dad there. But, like, to be fair, I think you're probably aware of this too, that I've never really been a person for, like, random small talk or to approach strangers to, like, get to know them. I'm typically more the kind of person that, like, wait until we're in a group and people come asking me about whatever. And I experienced this when I went to a story time at the library that was geared towards male caregivers. It was called Man on the Moon. And it was the library's response, I imagine, to this, like, a friend of mine calls it, like, the cult of mom. So, like, when you go to a lot of, like, these mommy and me kind of events, it feels like dads aren't welcome or, like, they're the odd one out. So they created this thing where it's like, okay, it's all the male caregivers. Not necessarily fathers, but it could be, like, uncles and granddads and whatever. So I attended one of those story times, and just, one, the vibe of the room was very different. It wasn't as, like, all the kids intermingling and joyous. Most of the dads were generally, well, most of the, I don't know if they were dads, but the other men were generally more, like, reserved and kept to themselves, which is, I'm just as guilty as that as they are. And so there wasn't as much of this sense of, like, we're all in this together, let's get to know each other. So I don't really know if that's...
Yeah, it goes back to the initial point that we are people in general rather judgy about other people. I mean, I if I'm on the bus and I see a parent interact with their child a certain way or an unexpected way, I mean, I automatically have opinions about that, and I'm not even a parent, right?
Right.
And so you're able to tune that out, I'm sure. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to function, right?
Well, you kind of thing, you know, like, well, whatever's working for you. And I think there's something that I wrote about it in the book, too, is that because I'm aware other people are judging me or watching me or whatever, I think that they are all the time. So there was one time that we were at the playground, Addie was doing her thing on the slide or whatever, and there was this little girl, I don't know, 3 or 4 years old, and she wanted help to get onto this contraption. I didn't know where her parent was. She's a little girl. I'm seemingly a man by myself in a playground surrounded by children.
Yeah.
There's certain assumptions that people could jump to. And, like, I don't want to put myself in that position. But, like, here's this little girl. She's like, please help me get on this thing. And I'm like, all right. And I'm like, 'cause as soon as I pick it up, I'm like, I can almost hear her mother screaming. And they're like, get your hands off my daughter.
Yeah.
And, like, she's justified in doing that, man or woman. Like, don't touch my kid. That's not your kid. But, like, I'm already so, like, apprehensive and fearful. We're doing this thing that's otherwise harmless. I'm helping her get onto this little contraption, right? So, yeah, I don't really know how to...
But it worked out, right? No one...
Yeah,
the cops didn't show up.
Yeah, right? But, like, I've heard all these... I've read all these horror stories, like, online, where it's, like, random man sitting on a park bench watching children play, and someone calls the cops, and it's like, oh, there's a strange man sitting on a bench watching children play. It's like, yeah. Because his daughter's out there.
Yeah.
Or, like, even if his daughter's not there, it's a public park. He's going there to enjoy his lunch. What's the big deal, right?
So at the heart of this book, I guess, is the fact that these are your experiences and the reader can take from them what works for them.
Pretty much. And, like, I've positioned the book so that it's part narrative because it's, like, my experiences, part guide in saying, here are the things that worked for us. But... I don't expect it to be seen as any kind of, like, parenting manual. These are exactly the things that you should be doing. It's just kind of like, these are the experiences that I went through, and this is how I tried to resolve them.
And looking back at it all, I mean, there's nothing really that you regret or that you would do over again, is there? Like, major?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Because then it's, life kind of is what it is, and, like, she's happy and healthy, and that's all that matters.
She's too young to understand what this book's about, probably, but...
No, but then what's funny is that she knows it's my book.
Yeah.
For some reason, when I got my proof copy, like, a month ago, I had on my bookshelf, among all my other books.
Yeah.
And I don't know if your listeners have already looked at the cover or whatever, but when she came into my home office and she saw the book, she said, oh, it's the teddy bear book. Because there's a teddy bear on the
cover, yes.
On the cover. She's like, oh, it's a teddy bear book. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. It is a teddy bear. It's Daddy's book. I'm like, how did you know that?
Well, the name is there.
Yeah, clearly she's reading
my name. She can read now, yeah.
Because I'm like, you know, there's a whole bunch of books on my bookshelf of whatever. But, like, she singled that one out, and then she says, it's Daddy's book. I'm like, how do you know it's Daddy's book?
Has she looked through it and seen herself in it?
I've showed it to her.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, who's this? What's funny is that...
Because for people listening to this, there are photographs of her throughout the book.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering what that's like for her to see herself in a book.
What's funny is that when I show pictures to her of her when she was younger, like much younger, she doesn't recognize herself in it because kids look very different in the first couple of years of their life. They change a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
But what's funny is that when she was younger, she didn't have much hair. And it took her until, like, past her first birthday before she had any kind of... anything that looked close to a full head of hair. But when I showed her a picture of her as an infant, she's like, oh, it's baby brother. I'm like, no, that's not baby brother. That's you, honey.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I was reading the book, thinking, she'll pick this up years from now, 10, 15, 20 years from now. And that's her childhood there, and that's such a great thing for her to read, what it was like to be around... how she was raised, I guess.
And I think going back to what we were talking about earlier with technology, the good and bad is that I had some pictures of my childhood and my infanthood. She has, like, literally thousands of pictures and videos.
Daily.
Yeah. So, like, I don't do it as often now, but I know I did, like, a lot in the first, like, 6 months or whatever. So, like, going back through Google Photos or whatever... she's going to be able to see so much more, and it's kind of it's kind of good and bad, because now there's so much material.
Yeah.
But it's, I hope that she forgives me.
Yeah, because parents do that. I mean...
And way more now.
Embarrass their children, don't they?
And that's why the dedication in the book says, I'm sorry, I'm probably embarrassing you again.
Yeah. If you were to have another child... would you raise it the way that you raised the first?
More or less. Yeah. I think that, and you'll get this from a lot of other parents who have had more than one child, is that your level of worry diminishes. With the first child, you, and speaking for myself, I tended to overreact to a lot of things. Every little thing's like, oh, is that normal?
Hmm.
Is that something that we should be worried about? So we took a lot of visits to, like, the walk-in clinics and, like, asking the doctors, oh, is this okay? Or, like, we over-researched things online. Like, was this normal? How should we deal with this? And, like, more often than not, 9 times out of 10, the doctor was like, yeah, that's normal. It's fine. Just give it a couple of days and it'll go away on its own or whatever. So, like, whatever issues she was going through, it's just like, yeah, every baby's different. They may or may not experience this, but most of things are probably fine. Like, we all survived, and I'm sure our parents didn't take us to the walk-in clinic every second date either, right?
Yeah. I mean, and do you wonder, because you have one daughter, how previous generations did it, having, well, you have a brother.
I have a brother.
Your parents had two kids.
Yeah. But, like, there are families that have, like,
six.
9, 10.
Yeah.
Like, my hairdresser, she's one of nine. She's the youngest of nine. And I'm like, I can't even wrap my head around how that's possible. And what she was saying, like, again, it's a generational thing.
Yeah.
Like, one, it's more expensive to raise a kid today than it was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Because we're kind of expected to have all these things. Oh, you need to have the car seat that's up to a certain spec, the whatever, and the shoulder needs to be up to a certain spec, and all these things. Like, oh, you should be taking these vitamins and all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, it was... the expectation was just kind of like, as long as the kid's alive, it's fine. Yeah. And it's that, that's not to take anything away from parents of that generation, but it was, they were more easily at ease of understanding that the kid will probably be fine. And it gets to the point where it's like, older siblings are more responsible for taking care of the younger siblings.
Yeah.
I can't imagine having, you know, 5 kids under 5 or whatever and trying to deal with that.
In one house, yeah.
But for the families that have, like, large families that have all these children, if you have, like, a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old, they can probably be at least a watchful eye over the 2-year-old.
Right? Yeah. What's next then? After, I mean, it's taken you, what, 2-3
years
to do this?
Which was originally, it was originally supposed to be a 1-year project, and it turned into a 3-year project. So I've had a few ideas, even before this book came out, before I found out that I was going to be a dad. After I finished Beyond the Margins, the previous book,
yeah.
I had a couple ideas floating around in my head, and I started thinking about possible outlines and such. But none of them have been really fleshed out or explored yet, so I don't really want to say anything on the air until I'm sure that I'm definitely going to be working on it. But I do have a couple of ideas. Whether or not I'll actually pursue them or not, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like this year, I've dedicated myself to having the vlog once a week, posting Instagram once a day, trying to finish a book once a month. So like I have like these challenges that I set out for myself. I'd like to continue publishing books. Whether or not it's profitable is another issue altogether. But mm-hmm. I'd like to continue publishing books just because there's something special about having that physical thing in your hand. Like I write a lot.
Yeah.
I write for various blogs and such. But to have this physical embodiment of my writing, it's different.
It's special because, as I said earlier, she can pick this up.
Yeah.
And
it's
see
a physical thing.
And she can see the first couple years of her life.
Yeah.
And what she was like, what her mom and dad were like, and what the people around her were like, it's a real gift for her, and I think for a lot of people that'll pick up and read it. Congratulations on the book. Good luck with it, and I hope a lot of people do pick it up because there's a lot in here that I can see is useful.
Yeah, thank you very much.
MichaelKwan.com is the website. Beyond the Baby Babble, Surviving Life as a Work at Home Dad. Is the title. You can get it on Amazon and all those places where people can buy books, electronic or otherwise. It's author Michael Kwan. Join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.